We ready? I start all formally and say, good to see you, Chris. So where were you? Normally start with just where you were born. Get a bit of background.
I was born in Oxford.
Okay.
Where my parents went during the Second World War.
Right.
My mother was evacuated there. My
from where?
Came from there anyway. From some London.
Okay.
And so I was born in Oxford.
Okay. You sound quite posh.
Well, that's because I went to Cambridge. I was brought up in South London.
Were you really?
So I'm a South London boy.
You've always seemed quite posh to me.
Yeah,
seeing you from a distance.
When you get to King's College, Cambridge, that's...
Yeah, posh is
you
right,
turn into.
Right up, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And growing up, did advertising have any effect on you? Did you see things around that you admired or had you inspired by? Or
not hugely, although I had a younger sister and we would play games with the advertising, which had just arrived on television.
Yeah.
Things like trying to guess the brand
early
as possible in the in the commercial.
Interesting. And what would have been the brands at the time that you... I'm trying to think. The first ones were Crest, who I spoke to Brian Palmer. Do you know Brian Palmer, who did the very first one? Did the Crest ad, that's the... Ice block. It was
that
the very
was
first.
Gibbs
S.R. Yeah. Was it Gibbs?
Gibbs
S.R.
Yeah. And in fact, I think Ridley Scott shot one of them.
Did he?
He said he did one for Surf later. Yeah.
Right.
He doesn't brag about it.
No. He doesn't come up on his CV now. And then a bit later on, you went to Cambridge.
Yeah.
To do English.
Yes.
To read English, I think they call it technically. So why, after being at Cambridge, did you get into the grubby world of advertising? How did that come about?
Well, I ended up at King's College, Cambridge, with absolutely no idea of what I was doing there. It had always been taken for granted. I was at a South London school, which happened to have a very, very good academic record. And it was kind of assumed that you'd end up at Oxford or Cambridge. And I got to King's College, Cambridge. I had never lived away from home. And I was really miserable. And after two or three weeks, I thought, I've made this huge mistake. It's going to be very embarrassing. So I went to the senior tutor and I said, I've got to leave. I don't want to do any more of this. And I thought he was going to go completely ballistic. But he said, OK, fair enough. What do you want to do for a living? And I said, advertising. Because somebody had told me, actually, that in advertising, you could make an awful lot of money and not work very hard, which turned out to be true, but you couldn't do both, as I found out later. Anyway, he said, all right, he said, I've got a chum in advertising called Alf Dubs, who later became an MP, who works at Ogilvy & Mather, and I'll arrange for you to have a day's exeat. We'll give you 50 quid in a train ticket. You can go and spend the day with him, see if you fit in. So I spent the day at Ogilvy & Mather.
At Ogilvy & Mather?
Yeah,
wow.
When they were near Waterloo Bridge. And Alf Dubs was a very sort of cool account man. And he showed me the media department with a lot of very serious people in suits on telephones and the research department. And I said, where's the creative department? Because I thought I'd be a writer. He said, oh, it's far too early. He said, they'll still be in bed. This was about 11 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
So I said, oh, right, fair enough. And he said, talking of which, it's time for lunch. So he took me to the Savoy Grill for lunch because they were next door. And he plied me with champagne and I really had nothing more than half a bitter before, as a student. And we just had the whale of a time. And we got back to the agency and the creatives had arrived and they were all pissed because they'd been in the pub all the intervening period.
And this is at Ogilvy & Mather, which is not the kind of grooviest, funkiest...
No. Well, there weren't any.
Like what they would call the civil service type place at the time.
Yeah. Well, like,
and even
like
that was like that.
Later. Yeah. And they seemed to be mostly trying to get paper darts onto Waterloo Bridge from the office window.
Right.
And,
yeah.
Anyway, Alf Dubb said, right, fine, that's it. Well, that's, giving you a taste. And he took me downstairs, put me in a chauffeur-driven limousine and said, off you go. And that was going to take me back to Liverpool Street Station. And he said, what do you think of advertising then? And I said, it's great. I said, how do I get in? And he leaned forward and he said, you get a degree. Slammed the door. And that was it. And I went back to Cambridge.
He sounds quite cool.
I got a degree.
Blimey. So that was you. So what year is that you got that little taste of advertising?
That would have been about 1964,
yeah. 65. Yeah. Wow. So then you continued with your education with the aim of getting into advertising?
No, I hadn't really thought about it. I've thought of all sorts of things like the Foreign Office and the things that my parents would rather I did than advertising. I think they'd rather I was a gun runner than
really. That was still a very dirty word, was it then? So how did you? So you left college. I read somewhere that you started off by failing the McCann's copy test, which
that's
might
right.
have been a good
yeah.
thing at the time,
yeah,
but.
The big agencies would send people around to the universities and to see if you had the aptitude, and I wanted to be a copywriter. And I remember part of the test was this chap, very earnest fellow, sat opposite me and said, I want you to give me as many words as you can think of for which there is no synonym.
Right.
So I said, OK, blue, yellow, red. He said, no, you haven't got the idea at all. Chap this morning, for example, he said automatic. I thought that was very good. Now have another go. So I said automatic. He said, all right, moving on. And anyway, so that was it. And I failed the McCann's copy test. So I ended up being an account man at O&M. And the useful thing about that was I spent a month in every department.
That was their training,
so I understood research a bit and media a bit.
So was there anyone in the creative department at that time who influenced you or helped you? Because there were a lot of good people who went through Ogilvy's at that period. I think John Webster, David Abbott, Tony Bricknell.
They would have been probably a bit
before
my time.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a man called Stanhope Shelton who was kind of like one of the Medicis who was ran the creative department. And he walked around the corridors one day and said, this place needs some pictures. I'll bring some in from home. And he lived in a moated house out in Suffolk somewhere. And he brought in these sort of Renaissance drawings, sort of Donatello and Raphael and people, and stuck them up on the walls. He was the one who found me on my own one lunchtime and came in and said, have you written this? And looked at what I'd written. And he said, how long have you been here? And I said, a week. He said, you've been here a whole week and you're still writing rubbish like this.
Right.
He said, you need lunch. Where would you like to go? And I said, well, I don't really know London restaurants all that well. He said, London? He said, you can't get a decent lunch in London. I'm talking about Paris. And he was. And he took me to Paris for lunch.
Jesus.
And that was the sort of place it was. And then he retired and there were three creatives. Dan Ellerington was one, Alec Worcester, who took over from him. And it wasn't, I mean, they were doing some pretty good stuff. They were doing Go to Work on an Egg and all that sort of, drink a pint of milk a day. Sort of stuff.
I've heard David Abbott talk about that Stanhope Shelley. I think, was he called, what's his name, Shelton?
Yeah, Shelley.
Did they call him Shelley? Yeah,
Shelley.
Talking about how, what a good leader he was. And I think there would be days he'd take everyone to the cinema or he'd say, clear the offices, everyone go to this museum or that museum or something. But so he discovered you what? So you were an account man trying to write copy or trying to become creative? What were you doing?
I was an account man in, and as I said, I spent a month in every department and that included a month in the creative department. And they said to me, we haven't got time to teach you anything. Can you write? And I said, well, I can write letters and things and stuff. They said, well, that's good enough. Here you go. And they just set me to writing. And I wrote press ads, which did quite well. And I also wrote some threatening letters for American Express, which I started getting much later when I actually qualified for an American Express card. And they sort of worked their way up from you may have overlooked to, you know, men with iron bars will come round and break your legs. And for some reason, I wrote a couple of things that caught the attention of the creative directors, as there were three of them then. And they said, well, we're short of copywriters. Do you mind staying on for a while? And there were copy groups then and there were art groups. It's hard to believe.
Oh, yeah.
The copywriters would write the copy and slide it under the doors. And
it's amazing. That's still in the middle to later 60s.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, late 60s, yeah.
Sounds like before the war, doesn't it, when you talk about it now.
Oh, God, yes. You imagine quill pens and paper cuffs.
So you were shifted to the creative department. And how did that go? How did you find that, the initial adapting to coming in at 11:30 and drinking more?
Well, it wasn't entirely like that, as I discovered, because it started at that point to get a bit serious. And like I said, you know, you can be very idle and make a lot of money, but not both at the same time.
Yeah.
And so I actually started to take an interest in the quality of the creative work and winning prizes and things, which we started to do slowly.
At Oglebiz? Because at the time, I guess you just had DDB and PKL set up, and then obviously you had CDP at the time. So were you very aware of that kind of work, thinking I'd like to do more of that, or was it a bit more insular?
Well, the great influence at the time, really, in the early 70s, I think we're now talking about, was America.
Yeah.
I mean, the commercials they were doing in America were just astonishing. The campaigns for companies like Volkswagen, Alka-Seltzer, are still the finest commercials, to my view, that have ever been made. And they survive because they have very, very strong ideas and beautiful executions, which is kind of all you need, really.
How would you have seen them in those days? Because obviously we're talking so many years pre-internet and probably weren't broadcast. What would they send over? Ogilvy would get tapes from the US and they'd... Well, not even tapes, probably reels. What, did they show them in a cinema? How did they...
Yep, they would circulate them. They would come over... I think it was the beginning of Sony U-matic and videotape.
Right.
And you'd actually get production companies in New York really touting for business. Cause
come over and show you all the American work.
Show you the new work, yes.
Wow.
But also, there, you were aware of the awards and the American awards.
The American annuals.
You'd suddenly see a whole bunch of stuff that you'd never seen before. And you'd think, wow, how on earth did they think of that?
And obviously, that must have been so different from what was happening in London. The commercials in London all through the 60s until about 70 feel so archaic compared to the American stuff.
Yes.
It feels like a 10-year gap, whereas they're running concurrently. But that inspired you to think, I want to do that kind of work.
Well, the whole group of agencies, really, I mean, CDP, BMP, they were all really trying to do as well as, basically, as DDB, Daldane, in New York.
So how did you come to leave Ogilvy's to go to JWT?
I went via slightly circuitous route because the head of my group, my copy group, we resigned as a group and went off to this tiny little agency which nobody had ever heard of and still hasn't.
And what's that called? Just that one?
It was called Stafford Winfield Cook, and we resigned as a department after 6 months. And he, the chap who I defected with, happened to be friends with a guy at JWT called Tom Rayfield.
Right.
And he interviewed me, and he'd seen a couple of things. I showed him a couple of things I'd done. I hadn't done a lot. And so he took me on to work on the newly acquired Guinness account.
Wow.
Which was just absolutely astonishing. I mean, it was the biggest
win. That one of the major, must have been one of the biggest advertisers at the time?
Yeah.
Is it Guinness?
Yeah, we used to make 16 films a year.
Wow.
And I didn't quite realise how prestigious it was. But,
what had they seen that what had you done that had led them to think you would be good on that? Do you know, or was it just a sort of circumstance?
I think they took a punt, really. I'd done a couple of commercials and written a few scripts and written quite a lot of body copy because people did lots of, because it was David Ogilvy's place.
Yeah.
So you concentrate on body copy. But I think it was this guy, Tom Rayfield, that just took... he had an instinct and he thought I'd be good at it.
And how did you find JWT after this agent? Also, I've got to ask, why did you go from Ogilvy's, famous, big, presumably lots of money there, to this unknown place that I've never heard of? What was the thinking to go there?
Well, it was the individual, this guy called...
Oh, I see, you Mike knew him
Buckland,
and thought...
Who said, come and join me. Okay. This is an opportunity. It's a new, hot agency.
Right.
And it turned out to be rather an old, cold agency, okay, and quite a small one.
So when you got to JWT, was that like Ogilvy's at the time? I mean, I would imagine in some ways they were sort of similar, but was it a different culture?
They were very similar in lots of ways. The population was similar. They tended to be pretty upper-class chaps, or else they were poets in their spare time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that used to be a big thing.
Artists. It was, it was quite like the Ministry of Advertising in some ways. But it was also terribly free. I mean, at JWT, you had this thing, you had a red plastic disc on an elastic band, which you could hang on your door, the door of your office, if you had your own office, which I was lucky enough to. And you could just disappear because people couldn't come in through that door.
Oh, really? The red disc meant that don't enter, not enter, like a
exactly.
hotel.
Yeah, you could take a great system. You could take a whole week off. And a week later they say, oh, I didn't see you yesterday.
Yeah, I was hard at it. So the Guinness work is, it's interesting, I was looking at that the other day, and it's very, I don't know, tonally it seems very different for the time. It's so playful and sort of, I mean, I was surprised, for example, the one that says Instant Guinness, the April Fool's ad, that feels to me like something from the 80s. And that was, so I was surprised seeing how far back that was done, because it doesn't seem, it's obviously not serious and it's almost meta, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was there, what was influencing that at the time?
Well, the Guinness campaign comprised some television stuff, which was by our sitcom stuff. But all the colour spreads and so on were actually slightly literary and intellectual. They were all sort of plays on words and things like intelligence test and those subjects. But the April Fool one, which was Instant Guinness, which pretended that if you cut out a panel in the ad and rolled it up and poured it water into it in a glass, it would turn into Guinness. And the saddest thing of all about that was we had complaints from guys in Wormwood Scrubs who'd said that their days had been ruined because they were so disappointed that when they tried it, it didn't work.
So people actually fell for they bought that.
Well, they claimed they did.
Yeah. So what else did you work on when you were at JWT? Were there people around you who were overseeing you, teaching you, inspiring you? Because JWT often, I think it's interesting, I think retrospectively through the 60s, 70s and a bit of the 80s, did a lot of really great work, but it was always kind of derided then. Were there? Did you find that there were inspiring people there? Did you learn from people there?
Yes, I mean, most particularly Jeremy Bulmore.
Right.
I mean, Jeremy Bulmore was absolutely extraordinary. And I've met an awful lot of people during my time in advertising who I would describe as clever or even brilliant. Jeremy was the only person I've ever met who I would describe as wise. And he was also very, very funny and very quick. I remember I did a cinema commercial for Guinness once, which was called The Shocking History of the Cinema. It's a couple of guys looking out from the screen, seeing the audience and trying to persuade them to come down the park.
Oh, wow. Like The Purple Rose of Cairo, Woody Allen film.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was that same sort of device. And Campaign reviewed it when it came out that week and said, this is completely brilliant and whoever wrote it should have their salary doubled immediately. And I bumped into Jeremy Bulmore in the corridor. We were walking in opposite directions. And he passed me and without actually even looking at me said, been moonlighting for Campaign again, Wilkins? and he was like that. He was so inspirational and so clever. And it meant that you could try things because he'd get them and you knew he would. You weren't going to be knocking your head against the brick wall. But I worked mostly on Guinness, because it was a full-time job. Guinness had been at the same agency for 35 years, and they came into JWT, and actually the marketing director was called Edward Guinness,
right.
And the brand manager was called Dermid Guinness. And they came into JWT, and they said, we don't know much about changing agencies. We've had the same agency for 35 years. We've only ever had one rule. You don't tell us how to make the beer and we don't tell you how to do the advertising.
A good rule.
Wonderful to be told that.
Yeah. So obviously if you're told that, then that does free you up to play and be a bit more fun. It's interesting that Jeremy was like that because I know him slightly. And I think what was interesting to me that when I read about JWT at the time is that they would come up with concepts for products as well. So it wasn't a sort of as dull as it sometimes appears. So I think After Eights was theirs. You know, coming up with a concept to use the sort of waste chocolate, the excess chocolate off of one of the machines.
Yes.
Mr. Kipling's, you know, which is the sort of thing that people aspire to do today, to have a wider role than just create the ads. Well, they were doing it then and they weren't one of the groovy agencies. But how did it feel like it was a broader remit than just ads, or were you just at the sort of ad end of it?
Yes, you were encouraged really to regard the brief as a problem for the brand or the product. And there were different ways of solving it than writing a new script. Sometimes it was repositioning something. And they took a lot of trouble over even the smallest brands. They had we worked on a brand called Basildon Bond Writing Paper.
I remember that, yeah.
And we ran a series of competitions, and it was trying to sell the idea of King Lear on ice to producers and things like that. And,
yeah, great.
And it was Dennis Norden helped us. He came in and judged them, and so
really?
People got involved. But you're right. I mean, they did develop a lot of products in conjunction with the clients, and the clients leaned on them a lot more than they would these days, I think.
Yeah. So, when you leave JWT, what was your biggest learning from, say, Jeremy Bulmer? Was there something that you felt you learnt from him that you carried with?
I think it was actually not to underestimate the intelligence of the punter.
Right.
And it's a thing classically David Ogilvy said. He said,
yeah,
the punter, you know, the customer is not a moron, it's your wife.
It's your wife, yeah, absolutely.
And Jeremy encouraged intelligence. And I remember I was at a lecture that David Abbott gave once, and at the end of it, he said, are there any questions? And a guy stood up in the audience and he said, what qualities do you look for in an art director to work with? And he said, intelligence.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that. And there was a cult of intelligence at JWT, which was quite infectious. And the clever people were admired, not the outrageous ones and not the brutal ones.
So you went to BNP then? Did you, or I missed
I was approached. No, I did. I was approached. We won an enormous number of awards with Guinness.
Yeah.
I mean, one year we won more awards at Cannes than any other brand in the world. And we won the DNAD silver for the best campaign of 30-second television commercials. Yeah. And I was approached by John Webster, who was at the Bosmasimipolit, which was pretty new at the time. I think they had fewer than 30 people.
Right.
And I was really very, very comfortably ensconced in JWT. I was a kind of precocious mini superstar because of all the awards. And it was a very comfortable and protective place to be. And the idea of going to this startup made me very, very nervous.
And obviously at that time, John Webster wasn't the John Webster that's thought of now. He was just at the start of his career almost. He wasn't that far in. It wasn't like, did you know much of his work at the time? I don't know what they would have done.
Well, he'd already started the Smash campaign.
Right. The peeling potato one.
He actually did the moon base commercial, right, with the astronaut going to get his food out of a machine, which was one of the early ones. But they were not necessarily, they weren't terribly well known for any particular campaign. But they were very exciting in terms of they were very newsworthy, and people talked about them a lot. And it was very nerve-wracking for me to come away from a place which had 1,000 employees, basically.
1,000 in those days. Wow.
And I remember John saying to me, you know, what's holding you back? Why don't you come and join us, come and join us. And I said, well, it's the security. He said, if you're any good, you'll be fine. You'll do really well. He said, if you're not, you'll have fooled us anyway, so you might as well come and take the money. And so I joined, and that was...
So did that feel like a big risk? It must have felt like a big risk.
Felt?
Like a big risk that you've come from somewhere where they value you.
It did feel like a risk. I was married and I had a family, and and they didn't pay me that much more. But there was such... Again, it was the intelligence that was clearly there. I mean, Stanley Pollitt, who arguably invented account planning, was a tremendous intellect. And he's the reason that the advertising worked in the end. I mean, Webster was the reason it won prizes, and I was a bit. But Pollitt was the reason that clients went there, because the stuff they did worked.
So did you work with... What did he do in terms of your work? Or what would he... How did he infuse the work with... What did he do? I know he was a planner, Stanley Pollitt.
Stanley essentially invented pre-testing and we really invented the animatic, and it was very, very primitive in those days. You'd be in a studio with cards, which you would have to drop in sequence in front of three different cameras in order to put together. And that was his idea, to start testing these things. Yes,
like that.
And then you'd take them out in rough form. And they were quite good, some of them. I mean, they were kind of cartoon versions of what you would end up with. And you'd play them to groups of housewives, normally, up and down the country. And then a group of planners, which had been trained by Stanley, would interpret the results. I mean, they weren't just accepted on face value. And the work would either live or die by that.
And did you welcome that? Because obviously most creatives hate that kind of thing. Well, they want to do what they want to do.
You welcomed it simply because John Webster accepted it.
Yeah.
John, I mean, an idea of his could come back and have been rejected by, you know, eight women in Sheffield, and he would say, oh, well, fair enough, back to the drawing board. And I remember a conversation between him and Stanley Pollett, and when another idea had been killed by, quotes, killed by research.
Yeah.
And he said, you don't know what it's like, Stanley. We bring this little fluffy bunny rabbit in and we put it on the table, and you guys get up in your great hobnail boots and you stomp it to death. And Stanley said, well, that's a very interesting point of view, John. He said, but if you look at it from our side, we don't see it as a fluffy little bunny rabbit. We see it as a tarantula. And their responsibility was weeding out the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
And John accepted this and trusted it.
Interesting. So how did it feel going from a 1,000-man agency to this 30-man agency? Was that in Goode Street at the time, or had that moved to...?
No, it was just in Bishopsbridge Road, right, where it sort of remained.
Did that feel cool, that there was like it was much smaller and friendlier, or a bit nervy?
It was more intimate, obviously. It was more... You knew one another much, much better. I mean, JWT, even the creative department, was three or four times the size of the whole of Mississippi Pollitt. And so people like Dave Trott, who was there at the time, and Graham Rose, who was my art director for a bit, there were only a handful of us. And we admired one another's work. We saw it first there in the agency. And we competed. I mean, we tried to be to outdo the next guy, the guy in the next booth.
Yeah. And what was the first thing you did there that made you settle in? There was that debate: if you're really good, it's fine. It's a really good way to kind of lure you in. But there must be a point when you do something, you think, I feel like I'm part of it now.
Well, that was part of what was nearly a catastrophe. I mean, when I first joined, as I said, John Webster had already done one series of commercials for Cadbury's Smash, the serious rival up against the Spada, and the space station one. And the day I joined, he gave me a brief and said, right, I want two more scripts for Smash. So I went away and I worked really hard for 2 weeks. And I took them in to show him, and I read them out to him, the script. And he then did something which I'd never seen anybody do except on the stage. And he put his head in his hands and he said, those are the worst scripts I've ever heard. And he was like that. He was in some ways slightly psychopathic, I think, because he wouldn't pay attention to who the person was. He would look entirely at the work.
Yeah.
He would just judge the work. Anyway, he said, look, I'm off on holiday for a week. I'm going down to my house in Provence. Think of something while I'm gone. Yeah, make it better than these. And off he went. Anyway, during the time he was away, I thought up the Martians idea, which took me about 20 minutes to write. And I
Where did that come from? What was the thinking?
Well, the thing about it was that Cadbury and Smash had always assumed that their only competitor was the potato. They didn't believe in competing with other forms of instant mash, and there were other brands. And so you had to really knock the potato. And that was quite a tricky thing to do because the great British public were very fond of the Spud. Yeah. They had an affection for it.
Yeah.
And also, the advantage was that it was more convenient and quicker to use Cadbury Smash. So it was a bit daft to do it the old way. But you couldn't tell the great British public that they were being daft by eating mashed potatoes.
You've been foolish for years.
Cadbury's. I mean, they're not going to sit still and take it from Cadbury's.
Yeah.
So it occurred to me that if actually you had a completely alien viewpoint on it, then of course, I mean, a Martian coming to Earth, watching somebody making mashed potatoes in the traditional way, would think these people are clearly bonkers, given the fact that Smash existed.
So I've read somewhere that you'd listen to the American comic was also an inspiration.
Yes, well, there was an American comedian called Bob Newhart, and one of the sketches he did was a telephone conversation between Sir Walter Raleigh and the people back in Elizabethan England about tobacco.
Yeah.
And it went something like, hey, you want to pick up the extension? I got Nutty Walt on the line. And, yeah, Walt, yeah, what do you got for us this time? Yeah, leaves. Okay, yeah, you sent us a whole bunch of leaves. Well, I may come as news to you, but come the fall, we have a whole heap of leaves over here. And what do we do with these? We roll them up, right? We dry them, we roll them up, yeah? And then we what? We put them in our mouths, okay, and we set fire to them. Mm. Is that what you're saying, Walt? And that was it. And it was it was the lunacy of...
Well,
smoking.
That's a brilliant use of reference, because I always say to the younger students, you've just got to try and find as much stuff out there, be like magpies, find everything. And I'd never connected those things, but when I kind of read that that was influenced as well, you think, well, of course it did, but you don't see it, you don't ever think it. Well, I didn't ever think it.
Well, our first thought was to get Bob Newhart to do a Christmas special.
Oh, wow.
And to do the same thing with the potato.
With the potato, brilliant.
Yeah.
Did
but
you look into that?
We couldn't get him to, we couldn't persuade
couldn't
him to
do
it.
Wow. Shame. Brilliant. So that was that one of the early first things that you did at BNP then?
It was one of the very, very earliest. Yeah, that and Cresta Bear.
Yeah.
John's brief to me on Cresta Bear was he'd drawn this cartoon bear and he said he's a kind of stroppy teenager in sunglasses and when he drinks it, I want him to do that thing that Jack Nicholson does in Easy Rider. And nick, nick.
Wow. So what was I got asked, what was the thinking there then? So you've got this funny, weird drink. I can't imagine what it's like now because it hasn't been sold for 30 years, but it's a very thick, strange drink. What is the sort of plan, if you can remember, the planning that would be, that would get you, what were you trying to do?
Well, we're trying to differentiate it in terms of what the different elements about it were. The first thing about it was that the froth...
Yeah.
On top of it was actually thick and white, and the colours were extremely artificial and to adult eyes, quite scary. So it was really all about the amazing colours and the frothy top. It was a frothy drink, not a fizzy drink.
Yeah.
And we wanted to position it, and that's why this grumpy teenager was the spokesperson, as a sort of slightly rebellious drink, not like the others.
So Coke particularly is a sort of the opposite of rebellious. I'm trying to think of what the word is. The opposite of rebellious. It's a totally mainstream good kid.
Yeah.
So you want to say
universal.
Yeah. So we're anti them sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the great thing about Cresta was the day we launched it, the day it first ran on television. Dave Trott was in a pub in the East End with a couple of dockers. And one of them was pushed a pint, which had a massive, great head on top of it. And he said to the barman, "What's all that in?" And the barman looked at him, and the guy standing next to him said, "It's frothy, man."
Brilliant.
And we knew then that it had taken off.
You got something,
yeah.
I remember that. And that then branched into all sorts of things, didn't it? How other uses, like books? How did you carry that across everything? I've seen the print ads recently.
Yes, we turned it into a strip cartoon, which was quite sort of natural thing to do, really, because it was in that sort of strip cartoon format to start with. And we even published some children's books, or rather Sainsbury's published some children's books, using the character. And that's it was exploited as far as it could go. It died ultimately, I was told, because Schweppes, who produced it, first of all, the rumour was they'd lost the formula, and it contained milk, which made it very unstable.
Is that true?
That's what made it cloudy and frothy. Oh, wow. And the second thing was they had a bottle shortage, and they used the same bottles as they did for tonic water. And no way were they going to sacrifice the tonic water business.
And they made more money from tonic water.
So it kind of just, it was a marketing decision that killed it, not the, it didn't become less popular.
You would have guessed it would be because it's too synthetic or something. I remember it being very glowing colours. And
yeah.
I can't remember why it was frothy. But yeah, I would have been one of those kids with the stickers loving that stuff.
Yeah.
And presumably it was in that, it was all white so that the colours really stood out of the bright orange or the bright whatever green.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. So also in my reading lately, I've read that the problem you had at BNP is that because you were very good with clients and at selling, they kept pushing you in front of clients and selling. And was that because you used to be an account guy or just that's your natural disposition or... And I'll explain why that was a problem a bit later. But
I think it was because part of what I had learnt and taken on board at JWT and by working with Jeremy Bullmore was an ability to, if you like, explain to clients and present the work to them in a way that allowed them to feel confident that it would end up pretty much as described. And I was a pretty good presenter. And in fact, Campaign did a poll and I came second.
Did you?
After Tim Bell.
Okay.
Well, and just ahead of Frank Lowe.
So the top creative. Yeah.
And so you're right. What happened was I got the job of presenting everybody's ideas to the clients because I developed this knack of selling stuff to clients.
And did that make you popular because their work was getting sold or unpopular because Dave Trott or whoever would say, why can't I go and sell this?
No. Nobody wanted to do it. None of the creatives wanted to sell
their own work.
To this day, you can't get Dave Trott to do a client presentation.
Oh, right.
No, what happened was that it began to worry me because I had less and less time to do any creative work.
How old are you at this point, just out of interest? You're still very young, aren't you?
What was it, sort of 75? I'd be about 30.
Right.
Yeah. And I was spending all my time selling work to the client. And quite often it was work that I myself wouldn't have approved.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
If you're not judging it and picking it, that's tricky to be given something that you either don't like or you don't think answers the client brief.
Well, that's what politically led to the sort of rupture with BNP, if you like, because, yes, if you don't believe in what you're selling...
Yeah.
Then it's a pretty dispiriting job.
Well, the bit that I read that said that because you were so good at that, they kept pushing you in front of clients to do all that side of it. And then when it came to when they needed a new creative director, which you would have been ideally placed for, they said, well, he hasn't written enough.
It wasn't that simple, actually.
Was it not? I don't know
because
I
when
that.
John and I were still working together as a team, and then I was working with Graham Rose, and we did a lot of good stuff. I mean, Graham Rose and I did a really great press campaign for Southern Comfort, for example. So there was a bit of work still being done, but my time was increasingly being taken away from that.
Exactly, yeah.
And I felt, ultimately, that I was not deciding what work was presented.
That you were presenting now.
And in the end, I mean, I was made deputy creative director. And that caused a lot of friction because a number of other people there thought I shouldn't have had that rank, even though I was doing that job. I mean, John Webster hardly ever presented anything. I mean, he just made brilliant stuff with his hands. But it led to a lot of resentment.
Yeah, that's what I read. So What did you think you was the biggest learning from John? Was there anything you would say influenced you going forward?
He was terribly pragmatic. And as I say, he had this almost psychopathic way of being able to judge the work entirely on its merits, yeah. irrespective of who had done it and what the circumstances were. The one I remember, the one key thing, when I was working on the scripts for Cresta, I mean, he dreamt up the character. I said, the thing which is really puzzling me, and I'd written a lot of funny lines, I said, is how to open the commercial. I mean, how do you introduce him and everything? And he said, how about this? Hi, I'm a polar bear, and this is an amazing new drink called Cresta. He said, that'll work. And it did. And it was as simple as that. I mean, he was very, very clear-minded.
Yeah.
And he wasn't entirely content in what he did. I mean, he desperately wanted to be a television dramatist. That was his dream. And that's why he ended up directing partly.
Yeah.
And he never quite made it. But he was such a brilliant television creative.
So how did that... It's funny, because I've shown him scripts before. And I wonder how that was with the department. So my example is... I just got to BMP and me and my writer had to show John some work on Alliance and Leicester. So, like you, it's a bit nerve-wracking. And by this point, he's done 20 years of amazing stuff. And we sort of nervously handed him the script. He kind of read it. And at one point, he put his head back and started laughing. And we thought, oh, my God, this is amazing. And he went through again and then he chuckled. And then he went, yeah, it's very derivative. And handed it back. It's such a slap in the face. You think, God, he's loving this.
Yeah.
So it was sort of at the same time, he found it really funny and just give the very cold, harsh, which probably right, but yeah, very derivative, I think. You think, wow, blimey. And I just wonder, so when you say this story of, could you do something like this, but good, or however he phrased it, that can be disheartening for lots of. How was his creative direction at that point when it seems like they were looking for other people to step into that role? Was that difficult? Because some people can't handle that kind of feedback.
It wasn't so much that. I mean, I think the teams had to accept his judgment on the quality
regardless of
whether it would work or not. There was nobody to argue with. I mean, there was no court of appeal. But there was one interesting phenomenon that there was one problem that, a creative problem that, was thrown open to the whole department, and everyone sat in a room with John.
Yeah,
and he said, "Right, let's hear any ideas anyone's got." And it was absolute silence. And then he said, "All right, how about this?" And he came up with an idea which was pretty much a stinker.
Mm.
And everyone's going, "What?" And he said, "Oh, how about we could do this?" And gradually, people realised that they could say.
Yeah.
They were free to express their bad ideas. And I remember talking to Frank Muir once, and he said that the reason he and Dennis Goodwin, Dennis Norden, worked together so well is because they knew each other well enough to tell one another their bad ideas, their worst ideas.
To get going.
And that freed everybody up because it's part of his... He didn't attach ideas to the owners. I mean, nobody owned ideas. Although, paradoxically, he was... somewhat forgetful sometimes as to where the credit belongs.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because one of those examples you give, I can imagine it closing people down because if you're sometimes too harsh as a creative director, people seize up and they feel anxious about showing stuff because they feel you don't like them or you don't think they're clever. And the other example is totally about opening them up by putting yourself on the spot and doing something bad then frees people up to say anything, which is where you kind of want to get to. They seem like two very different sides of the same coin.
Well, I remember David Bernstein telling me once that when he wanted to free people up to think of ideas, he said, let's pretend we're Smee's advertising.
Okay.
What would their best idea be? And that actually people then, because it was a game.
Yeah.
And some of the ideas weren't bad.
Yeah.
So that worked quite well.
Yeah.
But people had to accept... his judgment, because that was where the buck stopped.
Yeah, I suppose my question wasn't so much around whether people accepted his judgment, is whether that was inhibiting that harshness, whether that closed people down and think,
it might have been, but it was a tough place.
Yeah,
it was a really tough place to work. I mean, there were no prisoners taken. I mean, the competition between the creatives was absolutely cutthroat, and you would pull somebody else's work to pieces with without any compunction at all.
So by the time you left, what size was the agency then? You got there and there was maybe 30, you were there for...
I can't quite remember.
Was it, say, twice as big? I'm just curious. Because obviously it was
at least
growing.
I think it got about 100 people. Yeah.
Oh, wow. So it grew enormously at that time. Yeah.
And it was sort of then lined up with CDP and in terms of size. And I was a one-off to Saatchi's.
Yeah.
Which was quite
What made you do that? Hmm? What made you do that?
They offered me a job.
But, And how was that? So Saatchi's, I think that's 75. Is that right? 75.
That feels about right.
Yeah. So, again, that's a very different flavour of agency, I would imagine, than BNP and certainly than JWT. Was that... So the thing that you linked to the last two was they both felt very intelligent and thoughtful. Was Saatchi's like that?
Absolutely. Completely.
Was it? Really?
I mean, Jeremy Sinclair, the creative director, was a very cerebral, intelligent thinker about work. And actually, Charles Saatchi, as he's called now, was a very, very clever writer and advertising thinker.
Was he very involved at that point, 75?
He was in every day.
In the department, and he'd be around the work a lot.
We'd present our work to Charlie, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My most embarrassing conversation with Charlie Saatchi was... When the week I joined, he, up until that point, had had a huge afro haircut. And he'd had it cropped really short that week. And I bumped into him in the corridor one lunchtime, because I didn't have anyone to have lunch with. And he said, "How do you like the hair?" And I said, "Well, it's a bit of a shock, of course, because I had shoulder-length hair at this time." I said, "But, you know, it suits you. It's really nice. I'm thinking of having my own cut, of course." And he looked at me for a while and he said, "That's very interesting. But what I said was, how are you liking it here?" So, looking, digging a hole.
Yeah. So how did you find it there? Did you? That seems like another fantastically competitive, aggressive place from the outside. Again, it's on that massive growth curve. It's piling on accounts.
Yes.
What was that? How was that?
It was actually quite benevolent.
Was it?
For two reasons. Firstly, was Jeremy Sinclair, the creative director. The other was Tim Bell, now Lord Bell, who was the most charming man on the planet. I think it was Frank Lowe said that dogs used to cross the street to be patted by him.
Yeah.
He kind of held the thing together. And it was a tough place. I mean, there was always a sort of vague whiff of violence in the air, you felt.
Really? Charles, or were there many others?
You never quite knew. Right. But I think they sort of felt slightly like gangsters, Monke.
Right.
But...
So what did you do? I've seen the commercial that you managed to do the contentious line, "Bastards, it takes one to make one."
Yes, yes.
Which is ballsy.
Yeah, that was... Yes, it was, for contraception and birth control, And fortunately, that was a year when there was a media strike, and so it wasn't aired, but it was still deemed eligible to enter for the awards, which is why it won its award that year.
So you didn't stay long? Didn't stay too long?
No, I stayed to about 2 years, I think.
So at this point in time, who... were your kind of heroes, or who did you want to be, or what did you want to be? Did you have any game plan, or did you aspire to? What did you
want? Not really. I mean, the people I admired were the people that won the prizes. CDP was heavily in the front.
Did you ever go for interviews there, or speak to Colin Millward or any of those guys?
No, the Tony Brignall, Neil Godfrey, those sort of people, John Salmon. I mean, terribly gifted people and really a direct descendants of that American golden age. I mean, Bill Birnbach and all those great commercials of the 70s.
Mm.
And, of course, Frank Lowe, who facilitated some of the great breakthrough stuff, like the Heineken campaign.
So Y&R comes along. So you're at Saatchi's enjoying yourself?
I was kind of stagnating slightly.
Right.
not as much of the stuff that I was writing. And I was writing quite a lot. I wasn't doing any of the presenting.
Were you not doing any of that there?
No. I was purely I went there on the understanding that I'd just be a copywriter.
Right.
So I had myself an art director, and we did some good stuff. I was then approached completely out of the blue by Y&R, who had a kind of pro-tem creative director, although he didn't realise it at the time, called David Tree, who had been running Y&R Tokyo. And he'd been given the brief to find his own replacement, really. And they took me on at the age of 32. I think I was the only creative director in any Y&R office that had been brought in from outside. They always promoted from within. And so at the age of 32, I moved into this department of 56 people, many of whom were older than I was. And it was a pretty daunting prospect, but it was a great challenge because they had some terrific brands like Procter & Gamble brands, which were going to be very, very difficult to do anything award-winning with. But they also had tremendous resources, and they had brands like Smirnoff that you could actually turn into something special.
So how were they seen at the time? Was that an agency that seemed, I presume, quite safe and not anything like Saatchi's or BNP? So was it considered that you go in there to turn them round, whatever that means? You know?
Well, the article that David Riley wrote for Campaign, it sort of sums it up. And they were seen pretty much as being American, and a bit of a sort of American super tanker, and a branch of the head office. I mean, Y&R at the time was the biggest privately owned agency in the world. And it was the biggest agency in America by far. And the brief was to make it more creative, basically, to win more creative prizes. Because there had been a history of it. I mean, they had their work for Cadbury's and Johnson & Johnson and over the years.
And that had slipped and changed into slightly more stagnated.
Yes.
Because obviously they did all the Smirnoff work that's the effect is shattering, I think, the line was, which was very unusual and won lots of awards.
Yeah.
But then it had slipped into decline a bit in London.
Yes, I mean, the competition hotted up, and what happened was that Vladivar vodka came in, invented by Greenall Whitley, completely invented brand, and it was the rebel brand suddenly, and whereas Smirnoff had been before.
Yeah.
Smirnoff became the kind of mainstay and the safe one, you know, your dad's brand.
So in going there, what did you feel? Did you feel you were at the right age, or did you feel, obviously you took it, you felt challenged and... what was the sort of, I mean, you've got these different things where you've got amazing experience from JWT, BNP, Saatchi's. You've got this sort of arm of being able to deal with clients, which is probably even more unusual then than it is. Lots of creatives deal with clients today, but I remember for the first 10 years of my career, you weren't allowed anywhere near clients. There was very few creatives who could talk to them. So you've got that and you're expecting... Yeah, exactly. That was the fear. So did you think, well, that's a useful tool, I can use that and I've got that experience? How did you feel going into the job, the first creative director's job?
Well, I was uneasy about it in some ways, but looking back now, I think I suspected I was actually the proper answer to their problem, because I did have this dual thing. They had lots of established clients and I could talk client speak.
You're not going to scare them all off whilst
understand the research, I could understand the marketing theories and so on. So I could talk to Procter & Gamble in a way that they didn't scare them. And then we had things like, you know, Cadbury's were terrific. Cadbury's and Heinz were both terrific consumer clients. And the launch of Whisper, for example, won us a massive prizes, which came as a great shock. We won creative awards for Procter & Gamble. We won a gold lion at Cannes, I think, for Flash. We said at the time it shocked them so much they had to put up a shelf to put the award on because they hadn't had a place to put them before.
So what was your approach going in? You've got an enormous department, tons of resource, but did you sort of think, I'll try and improve these kind of brands first and then look across that? Or did you try and change the whole standard? How did you approach trying to improve standards?
It was clear going in that there was no way that all of the brands, all of the clients, all of the products were going to win any creative awards. You had to pick the ones which were most likely. And one of the ones that I picked personally to work on early was a brand called Croft Original Sherry, which I used Jeeves and Worcester, which I always wanted to use from the beginning. And Ridley Scott shot the first commercial. But, and we cast Jeremy Irons in his first screen role. And that was a brilliant marketing coup. Croft was a very old name in port, but they never made sherry before.
Oh, did they not? Well.
And the biggest selling sherry at the time was Harvey's Bristol Cream, may well still be. But the people who drank Harvey's Bristol Cream were faintly embarrassed because they knew it wasn't sophisticated because it was a sweet sherry. So the thinking went, if you made something which tasted like Harvey's Bristol Cream, but which looked like Tio Pepe because it was pale, then people would buy it because it was more sophisticated.
Oh, really?
That was the thinking behind it. So we needed to give it an instant pedigree, and that's why the Jeeves and Worcester thing fitted in.
Well, and was that quite early on that you did that?
Yeah. It was one of the first things I did when I went in there.
So was that when you started changing the way you dressed? So if you look at pictures of you at Saatchi's, you're like a hippie that I've come across, and then pictures of you at Y&R. You're in suits, bow ties, your slick back hair.
Was that
trying to appear grown up, or was that just how you'd always wanted to be?
I thought that's what creative directors wore, really, I suppose. But the other thing was, one of my leaving presents from Saatchi's, and actually it was almost from Tim Bell personally, was a whole bunch of suits.
Oh, really?
From a very smart Italian tailor in Jermyn Street.
So that was the new you.
Later on, I went sort of cash in again in that article.
Where it says, could you look more creative, ironically?
Well,
I think it said.
I bought three or four pairs of identical denim jeans, and three or four denim shirts. And I started wearing nothing else. And after 2 or 3 weeks, it began to be quite oppressive. It was a bit like being in prison.
Right.
So in the end, I just dressed in what was comfortable, what I felt like.
So how did that? How did you evolve out from your first? Was it a culture shock when you first went there at Y&R? Obviously, within a few years, you start to improve things. Did you get more comfortable as you go? I suppose I'm saying, did it feel difficult at first, but you eased into it, or did it instantly feel like you in your new role? Sorry, it's a long-winded way of saying, did you feel comfortable in your new role?
It was a comfortable fit from the beginning because people forget that they did have a history of doing pretty famous and pretty popular work. And there were a lot of good people there, a lot of good people who'd been overlooked and neglected by the previous creative management. And all they really needed was somebody to come along and say, hey, that's pretty good what you're doing there. And the task was really to bring out the best in those people who had done great work in the past in many cases. And the awards that were won around that period for Heinz Soup, particularly the Grandfather and Grandson campaign, and Cadbury's Whisper, which won all the stuff at Cannes that year. It was really just bringing back that kind of populist culture that had always existed there, and there were people there who knew how to do it still.
And what was your style of creative director? Were you quite harsh, sharp, encouraging, all of those? Or did you have a particular way that you would work with the people?
Well, I always thought that the best way to be a creative director was there's a martial art called Aikido, which is fiendishly mysterious, but which has no aggressive moves. So it's very difficult to stage an Aikido match because nobody can come at you if they're doing Aikido as well. And it's entirely defensive. And it's using people's movements and strengths against them without them realising how you're doing it. And how I set myself the task really of encouraging people without them feeling patronised, just steering them gently, just dropping hints here and there, looking at a bunch of ideas and saying, yeah, you know, that might just work. And there was no aggression, no unpleasantness at all.
It sounds like sort of David Abbott type of the way he works, a similar.
I wish I'd never worked with David. I obviously knew him quite well, but.
And at what point is it true that you, for the first 4 years or so, you barely wrote any work? You just oversaw and tried to get it together? I think that was in that
It was
David
quite
Wright.
A long time. It was about three or 4 years. Yeah. And at the end, I said, look, this is ridiculous. I'm not allowed to use the best copywriter I've got.
Yeah.
So I hired myself an art director from CDP, which is Peter Ibbotson, and sadly no longer with us. And we then started writing. We did the Smirnoff campaign, or anti-cheap vodka with the cut-out
lemons.
There's
two. So you did the, I think the first one was, They Said Anything Could Happen.
Yes. But we picked that one up. That was...
Did you?
The seed of that had been sown.
Yeah. And then the other campaign, I love that. I mean, there seems like there's a link through lots of your work, particularly the work I like, of this very good... rational arguments. So I love the radio ad that you did that I ripped off 20 years later, because they're such clever arguments for you can't stop listening, try again now, have another go. It's like it looks so easy and it's so obvious, but people don't do these things. And I also love the, which I tweeted out recently, the house ad that why people pay more for the one on the left than the one on the right, because it's such at the heart of the matter of what we do in advertising. And also I like the Smirnoff campaign that says, well, if you're not going to get a decent vodka, why bother paying for real lemons or etc., all of those.
Yeah.
It's sort of, you don't see that kind of those arguments around now in advertising. It doesn't seem like...
No, I think you're right there. I think what has been lost is persuasion.
Persuasion is the
in
word,
advertising.
Yeah.
Persuasion and rational argument. It's all become decoration in a way. And you now have commercials which take an existing piece of popular music, don't even bother to change the lyrics, and just put shots of the...
people enjoying the product, smiling.
Brands. Yeah. I mean, it's lazy, apart from anything else. And it makes no attempt to persuade anybody. It makes no attempt to change anybody's mind. And I think that's shortchanging the clients.
Mm. So it's funny, of the articles I read, and this might be me, but of the articles I read, there seemed to be a undercurrent of irritation that you hadn't done what the writer or some other people felt you should be doing. So, for example, there's people saying he could have been like David Abbott and Tony Brignall. He could have been doing this. He should have been doing that. And you think it's coming at it many years later. You think, why have they all got a view on what you're obviously the best person to decide what you're doing. And I can only imagine that they felt you shouldn't be at Y&R. You should be somewhere else, perhaps getting less money, just do it. It seems so strange. I don't know whether that's true, but that's how it seems to me. There's a bit in the Direction article which is astounding to me. So you're on the cover. So obviously it's any of those things where you're on the cover and they say, we're going to take, it's an interview with him and it's going to show you all his great work. And there's a bit in there that says, it's true that, it says something like this, and I don't know if this rings a bell. It's true that Y&R's creative work has improved, for example, and they name three commercials. Then they say, he had nothing to do with those commercials. He's worked on all the other stuff. And you think, why would you put that in an article that is a profile of you to say how good you are, because you're on the front cover? And there seems like a weird, I don't know why, or whether you recognise that or whether that's me reading into it. But it feels like, why do people keep saying he should have done this or he should be that or he could have been this?
Well, people did tend to do that. But
that's unusual. Why are they doing that with you?
I'm not entirely sure why. It's kind of like attempted puppetry. There's a classic remark that Dave Trott made about me, because we worked very closely together for many years. And he used to be very fond of football analogies. And he said, Wilco... He said, he's the Jeff Hurst of advertising, right? The only man ever to score 3 goals in a World Cup final. What the fuck's he done since?
Yeah, it seems... it seems hard. I've got another Dave Trott quote about you here, which is nicer than that one. Which, so there's a couple of quotes from the period. So John Webster says, he's intelligent, versatile and witty. He's probably one of the best 3 copywriters in the country. That's John Webster. Dave Trott says, on his day, he's a much better writer than I am. But he's a bit lazy, doesn't do it every day because he knows he can always come up with something, so he's never had to panic. So 2 of the best people in the business saying amazing things. But I don't know, did you recognise that at the time? This, it feels almost like jealousy or something. I don't know what it is, these little backbitey things that seem to be appearing in the articles that I read.
Yeah, I must have got up a few people's noses. People did have a pop at me quite a lot.
Did they?
Don White, for example.
Don White had a pop at you?
Oh, yeah, publicly. I mean...
Oh, did he? I didn't write it. Find
oh, yeah.
that one.
Oh, yeah. We had a running feud.
Oh, really? Why?
In campaign. I've never known why he picked on me, but I don't know. It's the tall poppy, I suppose.
Although I did find that you certainly gave it out as well. So, obviously, probably the best quote I've ever read in campaign was the merger quote. That said, when Macius was merging with Benton and Bowles, and I think you described it as like being lifted off the Titanic in Hindenburg.
That's right.
Was amazing then. It's amazing in retrospect.
I said that to the party, to a campaign journalist.
Did you? Oh, so you didn't know that was necessarily glibly printed?
No.
Oh, wow. It's a brilliant quote. So obviously you weren't keeping your counsel and just... And then there's another article that where... You're quite bullishly criticising lots of famous campaigns for having no real content or meat in them, which, again, people don't often do. People are not often confident enough. They're worried about how they're seen.
It genuinely, I think, that's the nouvelle advertising, yeah. Right? It began to worry me that... Clients were being sold short and the trade of copywriting was being disrespected, if you like. And it was as though, and I think I'm quoted in the article, those rough layouts that art directors do with the lines underneath.
Yeah.
The copywriter was just saying, well, you know, fill those in and you've got to say something. And the best press ads can only survive on the argument. The stuff like For Albany Life that Brignall and Godfrey did, stuff like that, and most of Abbott's stuff, is all about copy being read and changing people's minds. And an awful lot of advertising around at that particular time when I wrote that wasn't trying to change anybody's mind. It was filling space. I think I said the ads had the impenetrable gloss of marine varnish.
Yeah.
And it was lazy. I mean, people, you know, we need a photograph, goes here.
Yeah.
I remember somebody told me they went to a presentation with Ron Collins and they said, have you come up with an idea yet? And he just drew a line at the bottom of the pad and said, great picture goes here, great headline goes here. And said, what do you think of that?
So, I mean... It's funny to think you wrote that then, because now it's 10 times that. You know, now it's so hard to find any roughage or content in these things.
It is the way it was going. And I think the first sign of it was when we started taking people in directly out of art school, which is a good source of art directors. They then became copywriters, lots of them. And Dave Trott used to hire them by the dozen and weed them out. But you knew that you were in for a disappointment when you'd given them a brief and 3 weeks later they came in to present their idea and they were holding a video cassette.
Mm.
And it would start with, I don't know if you've seen that, and today it will be the same as you. Have you seen that YouTube thing? And basically it's now, it's got a lot worse, I think you're right. People are just lifting ideas, irrespective of whether they're relevant to any message.
Well, it's certainly gone. I mean, it's partly, I guess, things feel like they've sped up. you know, you get less times. It's interesting. You say they 3 weeks later they would come in. I don't know what that time would be now. It wouldn't be 3 weeks, but which forces people that way a bit. And I think when you've been at places like JWT or BNP where they're intelligent and they understand that a small shift in the way that you position something can have an enormous effect. I think now often to people it feels like it's just words, just those words and these words, how long does it take to do some words? It doesn't feel like there's as much value placed on it, and if that's the case, does it matter that it's identical to this Venezuelan ad that ran last year and won loads of awards? I mean, I've sort of, more recent times, have exactly that. People will show you something, generally a link. Now, and they go, we just want to show you this first. And then they show you what looks like they've transcribed what you've just seen onto a bit of paper. But perhaps in this one he's got blonde hair, whereas in that one he's got brown hair. And you think, that's sort of embarrassing, really. I feel a bit embarrassed. I don't know what to say because that's, you haven't really done anything. You've just found something that's appropriate. But I don't know where that goes, you know. I don't know. I sort of keep waiting for a change that...
I suspect that what people don't have today, which we had in the early 70s when we were starting, they don't have any startlingly good examples to copy or even to compete with.
Yeah.
If they were to look at the Volkswagen funeral procession commercial, the Volkswagen snowplow commercial, if they were to look at the Alka-Seltzer spicy meatball commercial, or the groom's first meal, there's a wonderful Xerox American football commercial. People don't see these things that knock them back on their heels. People don't see anything which makes them think, I wish I could have thought of that. Because actually they're just seeing things that anyone could have thought of. And I think in the old days there was an accusation that creatives in agencies like CDP and BNP were writing entirely for the DNAD jury. And I have over the years discovered that actually it's just as satisfying to write to make the client more money.
Yeah.
It's just as satisfying as making the DNA jury happy.
Well, I think as you grow up, you become more interested in that, don't you?
Yeah, I think...
In it being a real job rather than an outlet.
I think that's right. You're not just icing a cake.
Yeah.
You're feeding people.
So... how long did you spend at Y&R? It's quite a long time, isn't it?
It was 77. I think I joined in 77 and I left in 93, I think.
Did you really that long? Wow, 16 years.
No, it wasn't. Sorry, it can't be that long. No, it's about 8 years.
Eight years.
Yeah.
So why did you leave? I know what you did next, but what happened? 8 years is a long time in those roles.
Yeah, the moment came to start an agency.
Was that through frustration, or you? What led you to
it's
that?
It's a natural progression. Yeah. That's what you did. I mean,
lots of your contemporaries are doing that sort of thing, and you think?
No, it wasn't. I didn't have any great sort of global domination plan. It became increasingly difficult to work at Y&R because of the management changes. And we sort of, with the encouragement of Martin Bowes, decided to set up and try and do it like other people had on our own.
So they backed you, did they?
Martin? Yes, they did. Yeah. They took a quarter of the agency, which made it possible.
Right. I think I dropped my portfolio off there when you were... Was it Coptic Street?
Just around the corner from the old Pizza Express.
Yeah, there, when you just started, I think. I don't know when that was. But so how did you find that? Was that how you imagined it to be? I've started agencies and it's not how I imagined it to be. harder than I thought it was would be.
It was
difficult to predict. I suppose your view from inside an agency is very different from when you're sitting in a couple of rooms, phoning clients and trying to get it going. Was there any shocks initially early?
It was much tougher than we'd anticipated attracting clients, because we weren't nearly as famous as we thought we were among the clients. I mean, we were pretty well known in the advertising industry. But in the end, we did some pretty startling stuff, and particularly with the Sunday Telegraph and the Daily Telegraph. We won some prizes, and we ran a pretty good business ultimately, and made money. We didn't make a fortune.
No.
But we made enough to be a viable business.
And I should mention that you, obviously, you took with you your art director and wife. Were you married at the time, Sean?
We got married in 1990.
Okay, so you weren't married at the time.
No.
So I also read that one of the things that caused the fact that you hooked up with one of the employees at Y&R caused a tremendous amount of division and problems. Was that true? It's hard to sort of picture why that would be now, whose business that would be, but that was in one of the articles I read, that was problematic.
Oh, yeah. That was a...
Why would that be? Again, whose business is that?
Well, it's to do, I suspect, with favouritism, implied favouritism. Sean was one of half a dozen group heads, creative group heads. I was creative director. It was very difficult to believe that I wouldn't favour her in some way or favour her group. But she has that wonderful quote that Cosmopolitan magazine said. Yeah. You know, she said, when people sometimes ask me if I slept my way to the top, and I say no, because I know lots of girls who slept with the same people and they've nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. But how, if you weren't showing some form of favouritism, why not? Why would you?
Because it would have been absolutely apparent. I mean, it would have been offensive.
Yeah.
We had to be absolutely scrupulous.
Yeah.
And in fact, we were very scrupulous in terms of demonstrating any affection within the agency. I mean, there was no sign of us being married or living together, except for people who knew.
So when you start an agency, you're together 24 hours a day. I can't imagine. I hope my wife doesn't hear this, but I can't imagine a 24-hour day. Working with my wife, going over with my wife.
Well,
might have to edit that out.
Well, when we started doing it, people said we'd drive each other up the wall in 3 months, but here we are.
Yeah, 30 odd years later.
30 odd years later. Yeah.
So, is that how long you've been working together? 30 years.
Since 78. Yeah.
Wow.
Which is actually, how many years is it? Is that 40 years? 50 years, maybe.
It's not 40 50. Years. It's not 50. It's.
It's 40 years.
Yeah. 40.
Yeah. I think we were in our early 30s.
Wow, it's pretty good going. So, going back to when you were starting, what were some of the surprises that you found in setting up? So that's sort of late 80s.
85, yeah.
85. And then you moved into that great building in Soho Square.
Yes.
Brilliant building. Used to be Richard Williams. Yeah, one of the best buildings. How did you find it? The whole experience of just setting up, being on your own, you've got no backing. There's a whole bunch of experiences that I had that were surprising, or it's just a very different world, really, I suppose.
It was. I mean, we were fortunate, as you say, to have the backing of Martin Bowes and Bowes Massimi Pollitt. So we had a kind of safety net. But we did learn all kinds of new things. It's pretty domestic. You probably have found yourself when you set up. You know, you learn about roller towel machines and how much pencils cost and all that sort of stuff. I think the thing which probably oppressed us, if anything did, more than anything else, was the responsibility for the employees.
Yeah.
It is very difficult knowing that this group of people are dependent on your decisions and your skills and your talents to literally to feed their families.
Mm.
And that's something you've got to take seriously.
Did you find it affected your judgment? So, for example, when I set up my agency, my creative friends would say, it must be so great because you can sort of get the work to run that you want, or you can fire clients. You think, I'd do that less now because of what it means. So, you know, you can try and jam a campaign through a client, but that might mean that in 3 months you then have to let people go. Whereas if I was another person's agency, I would be totally, it's all this and it's not that, because it didn't really affect me. Whereas when you're in charge of those things, you can't help but feed that into your decision making, which might mean that you're not as ballsy sometimes as perhaps you would have been before.
I think there's always an element of pragmatism there, no matter how big an agency is. I remember having conversations with Frank Lowe when he'd resigned Fiat, which was a massive client. There comes a point, as Bill Birnbach said, when you realise that a principle is only a principle until it costs you money. Mm. And you have to make the decision as to how strongly you feel about the values you've built into the work you do. It's not like, you know, you're destroying the Sistine Chapel if you change a campaign. No. But it's only advertising. It's only rock and roll. But I think you have to maintain a certain amount of integrity, and you have to be very fair to your staff, and you have to be very even-handed and not favour some above others for reasons other than the work. The work, going right back to John Webster's stance, is actually all that matters. Somebody once said, you know, we are all the servants of the ad.
Yeah.
And it was... I think, looking back, I was more comfortable in a larger environment where there was a degree of security.
Yeah.
But there were unexpected pleasures. I mean, we had a junior creative team that I hired from Gold Greenlee's Trot, and they were very, very underpaid there, and we couldn't afford to pay them much more. But after they established themselves, after 6 months, I doubled their salaries.
Yeah, brilliant.
And they both burst into tears. And it was an astonishing thing to be able to do for somebody.
Yeah, exactly. That's the things I liked doing most, those kind of personal things that you couldn't do in a big agency.
Yeah.
You know. Interesting. I think in the you sent me over the agency brochure, and I love the first line, which seemed so... sort of slightly shocking and ballsy in a way, which said advertising is part of the entertainment industry.
I think if you read it again...
Go on, have I got that wrong?
It says it's not part of the entertainment industry.
Oh, is it?
I think it's not an art form. I think it starts off, it's not an art form. It's not part of the entertainment business.
Right.
It's a tool.
Okay, I'll have to read that again.
I think that was the same sort of period when I was knocking the Nouvelle advertising.
Okay, yeah, that makes total sense now.
It's because you shouldn't expect your clients to be patrons of the arts.
Yeah.
I mean, they're paying a lot of money. I had this conversation once with one of our clients who was a small client, Merry Downsider, and we quoted them 180 grand for some bit of production. And, I said, you know, it's not a lot of money. And the marketing director, who also happened to be one of the founding members of the family, that
Chris Carr,
said, he said, actually, it's a lot of money, you know. And I said, oh, you're quite right, actually. I said, that's a Bentley Turbo. And he said, yes, it's my Bentley Turbo.
So... there's one big change, I think, from then to now, which is, I think that when you were doing most of this stuff, it was about mass media, and now it seems to have changed into these fiddly little media channels where people get so excited about such small numbers. And obviously it's a very different thing, trying to create something for the masses. How do you see that? Do you see that changing the kind of work that you do? Or
no, I don't think there's any difference. An idea... is an idea, and Bulmore once said that you can sum up the idea of a great ad in 12 words. It doesn't really matter all about the media, whether it's digital, online, whatever. An idea will always shine through. The argument that those kind of channels like Facebook and Twitter and can be exploited simply don't hold water statistically. I mean, there have been a lot of studies done in the States recently, particularly with Pepsi and Coke, that show that it can be just pretty disastrous leaning on those outlets, those digital outlets, because people are not that involved with products. They don't think about Coca-Cola all the time.
Well, that to me seems like the biggest change that's happened since I've been in advertising, that the start point when I got in was people aren't interested in what you make or what you have to say. So you have to distill it down as much as possible and make it interesting. So the skill was to distill it in time and words and everything, whereas now it's can we expand it out? So often the content that's played, it may be like a 30-second film on how they make shredded wheat or something. And I don't think that people have become more interested in products or advertising or anything, but that's all the lengths have got bigger. So the whole skill of distilling down seems to have gone into how do we expand it out to create more of it, as if people are really interested. And I think my main tests are my kids. They're not interested in products or advertising. I couldn't think of anything worse than any of these. They probably hate them more than they were hated 30, 40 years ago. So, but that doesn't seem to be reflected in the output that agencies have now. It's as if the more we, I worked at one agency where they kept trying to make content. So how do we make a commercial out of this? How do we make a TV, a six-part TV series out of essentially how we make our product? Who cares? It seems just so delusional. I don't know where it goes. So obviously that's then spreads across everything because people lose the ability to be succinct, I think.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think it's an inevitable result of expanding the amount of airspace, time that you've got. It has to be filled with something. I mean, the media abhors a vacuum. Mm. And if you have to, we've had clients say, we're really committed to this, all this digital stuff. Something's got to be put into it. And the trouble is, it gets spread thinner and thinner and thinner.
Yeah.
If you take simply something like a headline or a piece of copy, there are only two reasons why people read anything. One is because they think it's going to entertain them, and the other is because they think it contains information which will help them or which they will find useful. Mm. There are no other reasons to read anything. And advertising has a much tougher task than, say, fiction. And I've had a few novels published, but once you've forked out your $6.99 for your Jeffrey Archer, you're committed to reading it.
Yeah.
But advertising, nobody is paid.
No.
And you have to develop a style which people don't stumble over as they go through it. There must be nothing to stop them getting through to the end of the argument. And that's Abbott was wonderful at that. I mean, you couldn't stop reading it.
Mm. So how do you try and dissuade people from using some of those media? How do you deal with it when people seem to want it because it's new? How do you deal with clients wanting to use that more?
I think people quite often want it because it's quick and easy and cheap. And they also want it because there are a growing number of digital agencies out there who will tell them porky pies about the effectiveness of what they're creating. And when you look at the numbers of people who actually watch terrestrial television, let alone Netflix and the rest of it, the big media are still what they always were.
Mm.
And television commercials are still
the main thing.
Yeah, the numbers are there.
There was a thing when I was at Mother that the head of marketing at Unilever at the time had sent out a directive, and I don't know whether this lasted a week or it's still going, where he wanted each of the people who ran the different product groups to use no more than 3 channels. So it didn't you choose what they are or figure out what they are. Because what was happening is they were trying to fill every single channel. A, it was diluting their budgets across everything, and B, it was distracting them across everything. They just couldn't do everything. So he said, choose 3. This is what's happening. This is what we found most effective. So if you then reduce to 3, you start focusing on it and you start applying your budget properly rather than 15. And we've got a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit there. Which kind of seems to make sense now, rather than, as you say, just filling up channels. It gives you some kind of focus.
Well, I think that's right. And I think the other drawback of having to do that is that there is a school of thought which says that young people particularly watch almost everything on telephones.
Yeah.
Which means that your constraints are increased, that you have to have things which will work in that small size and short time lengths, and there are certain messages that you can't do that with. And the flexibility of film and traditional television is part of its why it's endured. Mm. You're just cramping the communication possibilities unnecessarily.
Yeah.
Because they don't pay off. They don't work.
So going back to Davis Wilkins, you had a name change.
Yeah.
What happened there? What is that just a simple person left?
It was actually it was a financial business decision.
Okay.
BNP also owned a company called BNP Business, whose Jonathan Hall was the chief of that, and it made sense because their business, their client profile was very different from ours, to put the two together to get more critical mass.
Okay.
And more resources, and that's how it happened. Tim Davis, again, sadly no longer with us, my then partner, really was uncomfortable being part of that. He went off to run Unilever for JWT.
Right.
And then we just carried on. And we did a bunch of good stuff. Direct Line.
The Direct Line. You started the Red Phone.
Yep, Sean designed the little Red Phone.
And so how did that come about?
That came about because Peter Wood, now Sir Peter Wood, had decided that he wanted to test. He wanted to shoot 4 commercials and run them in different areas, because it was the days when you could run in different regions, and to see which went out pulled the best business. And whichever pulled the most business, he would then give the business to that agency. And he'd invented this thing of buying insurance, car insurance, on the phone, which was completely new. Before that, you had to fill in long forms. Yeah. He said there's a production budget of £25,000, which even in those days was kind of negligible. And so that's when John and I came up with the idea of the tabletop commercial, the little red phone on wheels, because it said car and it said phone.
Yeah.
And we presented it to him, and he didn't actually make any of the other films. He just said, okay, fine, you've got the business.
Because that's so simple, he didn't test it. He just said, that's the one. So did you carry on? You did that from when the agency stopped, and you still did work on that brand as kind of freelance?
We stopped working on them. For him, when he actually left that company too, I mean, he then went to he set up Eshaw,
right?
And we invented Sheila's Wheels for him because he always wanted a woman driver company. So we really invented Sheila's Wheels from scratch, including the group. We wanted a real group, a real singer.
And was that from a number of options? How did that come about? That obviously the faux Aussie thing. What was the thinking behind that?
Well, the Sheila's
Wheels, yeah.
Well, Peter Wood had long thought that an insurance company which was tailored for women drivers, who by and large statistically were a lot safer than men drivers, would be quite successful if it could be properly positioned. And there have been sorts of attempts to do it, but they were all a bit girly.
Right.
So what we wanted to do was to produce something which was a bit ballsier. And we thought, what are slang names, slang terms for women? Because they're not pejorative, you know, to call them chicks or dollies or whatever. And we came up with a discovery, of course, that in Australia, Sheila is a kind of neutral name for women. I mean, it's not derogatory at all.
Yeah.
It just means female. And from that came Sheila's Wheels, and Sean designed the car and the logo, and we cast the girls, and they went on the road, and they became a real group. And,
did they?
And it was phenomenally successful until the EU, in its wisdom, decided that insurance companies couldn't discriminate by gender.
Oh, really? So that killed that company?
Well, it didn't kill it. It's still a very successful company, but it stopped the advertising.
Oh, you can be it, but you can't tell people about it?
Well,
that's strange.
It's a complicated legal argument. And if Brexit happens, that may well all be rectified.
Right. So have you got your fingers crossed? And then also, so it's interesting, I was thinking you've probably got Britain's favourite ad and possibly Britain's least favourite ad. It's an unusual to have both ends of the spectrum. So obviously you've got Go Compare, which is one of the most famous brands around. So how did that come about, and what was your thinking to do that?
Well, we wanted to differentiate basically the name Go Compare from the other competitors in exactly the same way that the Meerkats wanted to stress the word market in their name. and the key thing really was that at that time the companies didn't offer much in the way of difference. And so, for some reason, the old song, patriotic song, Over There, came into our heads for Go Compare.
Yeah.
Because really, we were just after salience and memorability. And we listened to a lot of recordings, and we found one of...
Which, I've got to say, are good things to have in the advertising business.
Oh, yes. Exactly. Yeah. That's what we were after.
Sounded like, we're quirky. We like those kind of people to know about.
Well,
it
was something which was... It was... We found a recording by Enrico Caruso singing over there. And we thought, wouldn't it be strange if we had this completely unexplained Italian opera singer who appears at unpredictable points and sings the merits of Go Compare? And one of the things about it is the fact that people say, why is there this Italian opera singer, is exactly why it is there.
Right. So that was built in.
You have to ask, if you have to ask why, it's something that you're wondering about.
Yeah. And that's obviously the success of that has been proven to work. So you've got this unusual thing, which is a very polarizing thing. So on the one hand, it gets beaten up sometimes. On the other, it's completely grown an enormous brand.
Yes.
So how do you feel about the two sides of that? Because obviously you were saying earlier that you can't help, as you go on, to actually take some joy from helping people make money and grow brands, which obviously you should do all the way through. But as you get a bit older, that becomes more of a focus than thinking, will this win something? And I know, how long has that been going now, Chris?
We had a break because a couple of other agencies.
And that's what I was going to say, because it feels like every so often they get cold feet, think we should do something cooler, try something, it's a complete disaster, and then they come back. Yeah.
I mean, he is, the character is a very, very potent brand icon, probably the most salient one created in the last 10 years or so. I think the polarisation is a sign that it actually is noticed. People do take a position.
Mm.
It's much, much less resistance than it was in the early
days. Initially, really? Why is that, do you think? just become familiar.
An enormous number of people have saved a fortune on their car insurance.
Yeah.
And they're kind of prepared to live with him.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean, I think We Make You Famous is a pretty good thing to have on.
There's nothing wrong
with the agency's
door.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
For the clients.
Yeah. So, I suppose I'll try and sort of end on a positive note. And I suppose I was trying to think, what advice would you give someone coming into the business now? You've obviously seen it change. And I think the thing I particularly admire about your work is the sort of the logic and thinking. And it seems, God, I can't think of how to put this. I think that over the time, you've done very smart, clever, logical, persuasive ads, which I don't see now. And we sort of briefly touched on it. How would you... I bet a lot of people who listen, there's lots of colleges listen, don't really know how you approach doing that kind of stuff. I mean, it seems obvious to you and I, particularly to you. But how would you advise someone to do more of that? So, for example, I always say, you know, when I see students, I'll sometimes say, break it into two parts. Firstly, think of how you'd sell something to a friend if they were sitting in front of you, so you don't say anything silly. And then when you've done that, think about how you do it in an engaging way and you do it creatively. But separate the two. Think of how you're going to sell the thing, because often people just start creating like crazy and they don't think about actually selling anything.
Yeah.
I don't know how you would begin to tell people about this other kind of advertising, which is very persuasive and might use logic and might use rationality.
We had another agency brochure we wrote once, and it said the three most important rules of advertising. And it was get the brief right, get the brief right, get the brief right. Because an average execution of the correct brief will do some good. A brilliant execution of the wrong brief can do an enormous amount of harm. And I think it is to remember that it is not a branch of the fine arts. It is not the entertainment business.
Mm.
It is to effect, if possible, a measurable change in people's minds. Advertising is about changing the way people think. If they like a product, it's to make them like it even more, or to explain to them why they like it. It's an interesting fact that the greatest number of people who read any given car ad are people who own that car brand.
Mm.
And a lot of advertising is reassuring people that they've done the right thing, they've made the right choice. But it is to do with communication, it's to do with a message. And it's actually, if you sit down and say, what do people think about us now? What do we want them to think about us? What will make that change? I think that's the most important thing. Not what's trendy at the moment, not what are the kids watching, what's trending on.
So when you say, I'm going to be slightly devil's advocate, and I'm the student possibly at St Martin's, and you say get the brief right, you would say those three things, which are, what do they think about us now? What do we want them to think about us?
Yeah.
And what's the third one?
And what will achieve that change?
And what will affect that change?
Yeah.
Great. Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks for coming in. It's been great chatting to you.
It was remarkably painless.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Good to meet
you.
It's
been amazing, yeah.
Good to meet you.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, I hope you got what you need.
Oh, it was amazing.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry I misread your...
I don't think I've given away too many secrets.
No, I think you've been brilliant.
Not so...